Welcome to The Clarifier, where we take a close look at our toughest problems at work and turn that discomfort into advantage. In this episode, you get to meet Joshua Walsky. He was co-founder and CTO of Broadway Technologies.
I want to solve the hardest problems. And I want to solve them, you know, myself. You know, I want to do it and feel the feedback from doing it, right?
But as his company scaled, he still wanted to be the one who came up with the solution. It got hectic.
I just remember one night after months of phone calls, I was sitting out in my bedroom and the thought crossed through my mind. I was like, I have a camping tent in my closet. I could just grab it and go. No more phone calls, throw my cell phone in the water, just gone. And that was because I was, you know, wearing so much of the risk and had created a situation where I believed I was the one to solve.
Through coaching, he came to understand what felt wise and virtuous actually narrowed what he and his team could achieve together. In order for his team to excel, he needed to revamp his approach as a manager. I'm so grateful Joshua is sharing his founder journey with us today to explore the hidden costs of failing to delegate and the problem with trying to win by coming up with the answers yourself. Joshua has worn many hats, but throughout his career, he has always identified first and foremost as a software developer. Engineering culture makes sense to him.
What drew me to engineering was problem solving, getting my hands dirty, taking things apart, figuring out how they work, putting them back together, dealing with the parts that were now lying on the side that should have been back. but it's something, you know, I really enjoyed. I had then a particular interest in software and computer science, and some of that, you know, was related to when I was going to college, what was available and what was exciting and new at the time.
Who were some of the people you looked up to who were kind of the rock stars or the idols of the tech world at that time?
I hate to date myself, but I graduated from college in the dot-com boom. So, computer engineers, computer scientists were really coming into their own at that time. I mean, already, you know, there was idolization, people like Bill Gates, who was a software engineer, founded a company. Linus Torvalds, the first version of Linux kernel was released when I was a freshman in college, but we knew about it. Geek chic was starting to be a thing. We had, you know, I had classmates that had gone on to found dot coms that, you know, went public in the dot com boom and was, you know, happening right next to me. So, not only was there this great excitement around engineering, I personally found it extremely interesting, and fulfilling and, kind of problem solving that I liked, but, you know, this is what I saw, you know, the first time engineers could be rock stars, right? There was this public attention of what was going on with the internet, and hardcore engineers were heavily sought after, right? And the more hardcore and the better you were at engineering, the more excitement there was around you.
This push to be the best was enthralling to him.
You know, the idea that I could solve a problem that was either known to be harder that other people couldn't solve was just very exciting. And it really was, you know, being up for a challenge that was known to be difficult and known to be distinctive. And I was, you know, drawn to that.
After college, he went to work at Trilogy, a software company. Their tagline was literally only the best. Joshua knew he loved tough computer science problems. But Trilogy exposed him to business entrepreneurship for the first time, and he liked it. He worked with a small team to build a new business selling cars online, which at the time had never been done before.
We were given the opportunity, actually, if I'm better to say it, to take business risks and do things that, you know, would be perceived crazy 20 years ago, you know, as literally kids out of school. We were launching a business that had a tremendous need for capital and was spending that capital. We were selling cars. In fact, we were selling cars at a loss. You only need small fractions of a percentage point before that becomes very meaningful. So you know, we took a shot and we worked hard. We raced to reach deadlines. We met some of those deadlines. We were selling cars without really having complete background in what it would take to run a business. But ultimately, we saw it as a challenge and we were going to tenaciously pursue that challenge until we couldn't anymore. There was no giving up. There was no stopping. This was our goal and we were just going to go as hard as we could until it was done or someone pulled the plug on us.
Joshua and his peers are grinding hard, working 80-hour weeks, essentially running a startup inside a larger company. And their work is getting noticed.
We're getting our launch. We're getting customers. We're getting accolades within the organization. We're getting people given to us to like grow the company, right? We're getting increased funding effectively. And so that is building, you know, both a confidence and ability to be able to do it, as well as feedback saying, hey, it's good to do this. This is how you succeed, both as an individual and as an organization. You know, solving these problems yourself, hands-on, figuring it out is a good thing.
But over time, the nature of the work shifted.
So dot-com boom was followed by dot-com bust. So I got to live through the dot-com bust and actually experience, you know, a different side of business and having to make some of those hard decisions saying, wait, we don't have the funding we used to have. All of these, you know, it gave me a perspective on this run fast, go hard, also has, you know, potential future impacts that you need to manage. So went through the boom, went to the bust. Ultimately, the parent company decided they needed to wind down the investment, so they wound it down. Following that, and a brief stint back, you know, I went back to school, got a master's, connected up with one of the other people that I had met through Corridor, Tyler, and we ended up founding Broadway Technology. Broadway Technology, again, was very much an engineering-focused organization. We were going to build some of the hardest software we could think to build and sell it to banks.
And what did it do?
It was enterprise-class front office software for large-scale financial institutions. And so I'm sure the audience is like, what in the world does that mean?
Is there a click more of explanation you want to give us, or should we leave it at that?
Basically, it is the software that is managing for a large-scale finance institution like, you know, like Barclays or Goldman Sachs or Bank of America. It is what is managing all of the transactions for their trading desks. At enterprise level with large customers, it's dealing with compliance, it's dealing with transaction recording, it's dealing with market data. So think, you know, billions, if not trillions of dollars worth of transactions, extremely high frequency, high degree of correctness, high degree of complexity. So it can, some of the most complicated software and complicated engineering we could think to get involved with. You said, oh yeah, let's do that one. We can do that.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah. Well, I'm sort of hearing a theme here around being able to solve the hardest problems, being a source of distinction and value add for you.
And pride, quite frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So you finish your master's degree, you reconnect with Tyler, you craft this idea for Broadway. And then tell us a little bit about starting off as a co-founder. Was it similar to what you had been doing inside of Trilogy? Really focused on just lining up the hardest problems and solving them one by one? Tell us about the experience of that.
Again, and very much early on, and I suspect a lot of engineering-led organizations early on, it's get the products to work, solve the problem. And it was very many hours getting, you know, solving the problem for these financial institutions. We were our first customer. We were going to work very closely with them and we weren't going to quit until it worked. There were, you know, long days on planes. They were actually out in LA. So I spent a lot of time commuting between Boston and LA, which is quite a commute. One of the things that really surprised me, I was the only crazy person who did that commute every week. I would like at 6 a.m. on the Monday morning flight, there were like five or six of us, and we were there online every 6 a.m. Like, you guys are all crazy. We're crazy. We fly back on Friday, same set of people. But it was, it's very much hard charging. You know, we're going to solve this. We can do it. No one else can. This is a problem that if we can solve, there will be value add and we can build a company.
Joshua is building a culture that places a high value on solving the hardest problems. But he's still seeking the thrill of solving those problems himself.
I would hazard to guess that, like mountain climbers, right? There's only a few who've climbed at the big mountains, and they know they've gotten on top of Everest or whatever, when not everybody can do that. They were able to achieve a thing that is distinctive. So there's kind of, you know, and I definitely myself, you can probably hear it in my voice right now, I'm drawn to being, to trying to solve those distinctive problems.
As they earn bigger and more complex problems to solve, Joshua has to build out his team, which means he has to manage other people.
There's a point in one's career in engineering, you know, where there's potentially two paths. There's the, do I stay an engineer, go left and stay an engineer? Or do I, you know, take the right fork and become, start managing and look to, you know, be a leader of the organization through management? You can obviously be it as an engineer, but it's a very different kind of leadership. And at some point, you know, you can try straddling these two for a while, but at some point you need to decide. And one of the things that, as I look back, I realize some of those attributes that make one excel as an engineer, because it's not just about coding. When I first used to pose this fork in the road, I thought it was about time, because it took time to code. You just couldn't, you didn't have the time because you need to spend, you know, hours and hours debugging and thinking about how things were built. And at some point, if you're managing, you just don't have the time. So I thought it was about time. There are some of those things that make one excel in engineering that actually become problematic when you start trying to manage people. And that's one of the insights or hindsights, call it, you know, that I've had going through this journey, is recognizing those things that I love doing that made me good at engineering actually ended up being somewhat counterproductive.
As a fun little game, I'd like for you to guess, right now, in your mind, how many direct reports Joshua had at Broadway. Okay, do you have it? 35. The correct answer is 35. At one point in time, he had 35 direct reports. His impact on the organization was pretty profound.
As a manager, has become more clear to me is how that actually ends up limiting the potential of your team. And it limits it in a way that's very interesting. Because at first I found, you know, my desire to jump in and solve the problem was beneficial. And being part of a team, I had more people, there's more time. So it wasn't just about, you know, in my head it was, well, now I can solve the problem. And instead of me having to spend 3 weeks coding the problem I just solved, there's other people to help with that. So
yeah,
in some ways, it was just a lever on solving the problem, right? Now I could solve, because I didn't have to, you know, the details are left as an exercise for the reader, right? Like I got to solve it at that level. And that also was very exciting. But what I didn't see was that in that, I took away the opportunities for other people to solve the problems. And one of the things that makes someone better at solving problems is practice. Just like anything, it's practice. So as a manager, being, you know, the one of the key problem solvers prevented those people who were still learning from getting as many cycles as they needed to really excel at that activity. And that was the piece that I didn't see.
When did you, what you're saying makes sense, right? If you're the one solving the problem, even if others are involved, you're still getting the practice. You're still getting the learning. And it might feel good because you're helping others who might be stuck without you. The team's probably getting to an answer faster than if everyone was left to their own devices without you. Folks are probably enjoying spending time with you and getting attention from the boss. And so it all kind of feels like it's going well. What was it in that context where everything seemed to be going well that kind of had you stop and pause and say, wait, what's maybe the second or third order consequence of my implicit, maybe even unconscious choice to have my hands all over these problems and be the one solving them?
Yeah. So I think you also pointed out a great point. It was it was clearly a positive feedback loop. Everything, mm-hmm. Seemed to be working great. It was not obvious, I think, to me or the team or very many people, the deficiencies of this solution. It was working. And it's not like there was a Icarus moment where this structure got too close to the sun and our wings melted and it all came crashing down. It was more me looking at it in hindsight with a different lens, a lens that had been, provided to me of like, well, look at what the potential of the people. Are we able to maximize the, and I absolutely hate when people get called resources, but I'm about to go do it. Were we able to maximize the intellectual resource we had? And I think in the short term, we were. But in the long term, we didn't, I didn't, build and help encourage to grow, because I wasn't building them, I was really encouraging them to grow, the next set of problem solvers who were going to be as good, if not better than I was, by in some ways being so involved and getting all the practice. They didn't get as much practice as would have, which have increased their learning faster.
I think managers often face this choice. Should I do it? Should I tell them how to do it? Or should I let them figure out how to do it on their own? And in the short term, doing it and telling them how to do it usually gets to the required end result faster. How, maybe now in retrospect or at the time, do you think you would guide managers to think about that trade-off, right? Because it's not always obvious. I don't know, if you were trying to apply some financial calculus to it, there's probably some discounted cash flow or net present value or something like that.
Yeah. It's a very complicated optimization problem. I'll write that down on my list of problems to solve one day.
Yeah, but it's not obvious that the right choice is to step back either. So you're talking about reflecting in hindsight. Do you think you did something wrong, or do you think you did what was necessary in the early days of the company to get it off the ground?
So I think, so I'm also going to answer your question, like, what do we tell managers to do, right? But let me start. I think in the beginning, it was probably more necessary for longer than I continued to do it. Does that make sense? Because it's not necessary. It's not binary. It's like, is it more necessary now? What are the risks of not doing it this way? And, the tighter the room to maneuver, the less operating space you have, less margin, less people, the less, the more critical the deadlines, probably more important that you leverage all of the experience of the best problem solvers at the moment. But also recognizing that comes at a cost of not giving the new problem solvers the reps to become the better problem solvers in the future. And I didn't think about it that way. I thought about it only as, well, this is the problem. We need to attack the problem in front of us as aggressively as possible, and never thought about what I was borrowing from the future to that. And part of it was because I was so excited about the problem. Oh, this is a problem. Let's go attack it. Like, it wasn't even that I considered it and was like, nah, this is more important. It wasn't even a thought. So one of the things that I think about in hindsight, and then I think, you know, makes sense to consider in those decisions is, okay, we're doing it this way, and these are the trade-offs. I'm going to make this decision, recognizing that that is going to borrow from the future, not just, oh, we're going to solve the problem now, but purposely, intentionally, we're going to solve it this way because we want to get these third and fourth order effects.
This challenge comes up all the time when I'm coaching founders. How do I solve this immediate existential problem without sabotaging the future I want to build?
I remember a project that it was with a European client. And again, when, you know, I had very much taken a lead role in that project in direct hands-on responsibility. And you know, we were getting for months on end, you know, being a European client, when there were problems, they were in European hours. So I'm getting phone calls at 3 a.m. On a routine basis. You know, it's not clear whether or not we're going to get the project done on time. There's big deadlines. There's a lot of pressure. And I'm wearing all of this pressure. Right? And again, there were great people around me, but because of because of not encouraging them years ago and giving them the opportunity to learn as much and as fast, you know, they were not able to contribute as much as at the time I needed, but I also didn't realize that that was my fault. I didn't set them up. It wasn't that I also hadn't given others the opportunity. I also, in my heart of hearts, believed that I was the one to solve it. I'm an engineer. I saw a problem. I was the one to solve it. Mm. Again, if we go back to that fork in the road, you know, what I now realize as an excellent manager, right? You know, and this is how we describe a manager. They achieve things through the work of others. Right? That is exactly opposite from I'm the one to solve the problem. Right? And again, I had taken that fork in the road. I'd stopped coding ages ago. But what I hadn't let go of was the I'm the one to solve the problem. Yeah.
Today, as a coach, how do you use that experience to help, whether it's founders or engineering leaders, recognize when that really implicit belief, I'm the one to solve the problem, and maybe a correlated belief, other people aren't ready or good enough? How do you recognize when that's coming up, and how do you help them with that?
Working with kind of newer founders is really just exposing this perspective and say, hey, you need to think about this. Those things that made you great here may actually be liabilities for you now in this role. Does that mean that you shouldn't do the role? No, not necessarily, but you need to be aware of it. Does that mean that maybe someone else should do that role? Maybe, because if you really love solving problems, you really love coding, hey, right? The biggest thing that, you know, both I learned from having a coach, I think, as well as one of the things I love to pass on, is being purposeful and thoughtful and aware. Right? Don't make a decision. Don't make an implicit decision. Every decision should be explicit. And that requires a certain set of perspectives and, you know, being aware of blind spots. You know, to me, this was a huge blind spot. I didn't know any of this stuff existed. So going back to your question, how do I, you know, help people that I'm coaching, it's really trying to expose this question. Hey, is it you need to solve this problem or this problem needs to be solved? Is it you want to solve this problem? And it's not that one answer is wrong or right. It's that the answer just should be purposeful and intentional.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit. You mentioned that you had a coach. I think it was a talentism coach, right? When did your talentism coach come into the picture? And it sounds like the coaching journey helped you see some costs and some trade-off that were previously hidden that then became part of your explicit decision-making. Oh, do I want to solve the problem myself and get the short-term reward? Or do I want to let others solve the problem and get the long-term reward of training and evaluating tomorrow's leaders? right? Tomorrow's problem solvers. So I'm hearing that that's kind of what came out of it. Tell us about the experience of it. How did you start to see that with your talentism coach?
Yeah, well, I think the one of the biggest things that the coach brought to me was very much a different perspective and recognizing that I was interpreting the world through my perspective, and therefore I created my own narratives. That wasn't the world. That was my view of it. I was in a system. I was contributing to the system. It was perpetuating. And it was, you know, very hard for me to recognize that in it. I was busy. We were succeeding. We were doing this. Like, it just kept going and going, right? And you know, having a coach help me step out of the system and say, hey, let's pretend, you know, think of yourself as an actor in the system as well as observing the system. The only way you can change a system is by your own activity, right? So you have to observe your activity in the system. And the coaching really helped get me that perspective. Then having the responsibilities of being an executive in the organization, I obviously had greater ability to affect the system than others.
Mm-hmm.
But even that awareness, we used to say, you know, responsibility is taken, not given. I'm sure you've heard that a thousand times, if not more.
Was that an important learning for you about whether you were creating an environment where others could take responsibility?
And the reason I brought this up is I realized one of the things, while I would say exactly that, hey, you want this project, go take it, I also realized that I was actually in some ways standing in the way of that. Because to me, it also means taking risk, right? There's risk associated with it. And the other thing that I think is probably more so as a founder, is growing risk aversion as your level of success increases, right? I've heard it said about an entrepreneur is not really a risk taker. An entrepreneur is someone who takes one risk. And from that point forward, they spend the rest of the time protecting that.
Yeah.
Right? And you know, whether or not that's true, it definitely spoke to me that as, you know, the company got bigger and we had more people and projects, you know, there was just a growing, you know, risk aversion. And that in some ways stood in, oh, I need to make this decision, right? Because we built this thing, we don't want to put it at risk. It's part. So in some ways, there are compounding factors making that very challenging.
It's one more way your brain tells you, I am right and justified in being the decision maker here. That's safer than taking the risk on giving others the chance. So what happened with Broadway?
In 2020, you know, Broadway went through a series of M&A transactions. It had a very successful exit. You know, it gave me the opportunity to kind of be in a new context. And that new context really helped me reflect on, you know, everything had gotten to that point and what we had created. And in some ways helped me, you know, continue my next journey of trying to, you know, figure out how to best help the next set of entrepreneurs.
What's something that you want to make sure the founders and technical leaders that you coach really understand?
Be aware of the shadow you cast and how it contributes to your own perception of the people around you. If you think they're not good enough, is it because they're actually not good enough? Or is it because you're standing in their light? Chances are, it's a little more the latter than the former. A lot of, you know, software engineers are treated as the talent of their company, right? And they perceive them as such, and I perceive myself as such. Those then have impacts as you go try and be a leader and build a company, and be unaware of those puts you at a disadvantage. At least be aware of the impact. You know, you may think you're great, and I certainly, you know, thought I was great. I still think I'm great, you know, with that. But I also need to recognize that a lot of that was the system that I created. I got the reps. I got the chances. That made me better. Yeah, I was in some ways better at it because I took all the chances. I took all the learning. That wasn't something inherent to me. That was the system and the position I was in. So to be purposeful and understanding about those things, and it'll give you the opportunity to be able to do, you know, more, but it may not be yourself. It may be others.
Oh, that last sentiment was so powerful. I just want to sit in it for a minute. Being aware of the system you're creating that is maybe giving you the preferential treatment when it comes to reps and building expertise and building credibility kind of becomes self-fulfilling, right? If I'm the one with the most expertise in the room, I get the decision. I get to compound on that expertise because I keep making the decisions and learning from my own track record. And then also recognizing, oh, at a certain point, that's really limiting. That's really limiting in terms of what I'm going to be able to achieve, because that's the only expertise I can deploy is my own.
Exactly. And it is fundamentally limiting. And one of the great things about companies is there doesn't need to be a limit. It's not like a professional sports team, right? Where there's a closed game and either you're winning or the other person is winning. When it comes to, you know, building an organization and, you know, having and finding people excel, the more the better. I can be good at it, and this person can be good at it, and that person can be good at it, and that person can be good at it, provided, you know, those with the opportunities make space and really make space, not just say they're making space.
These days, Joshua is building out technology solutions for talentism. He has to get those engineering thrills somewhere. And as a talentism coach, he helps leaders spot the unseen risks that could restrict growth and be more intentional with their choices around management, so they don't ponder grabbing their camping tents in the middle of the night and leaving it all behind. Big thanks to Joshua for sharing his founder journey. If you relate to anything Joshua mentioned in this podcast, or want to learn more about how you can be more effective in managing your team, come have a chat with someone at Talentism. Drop us a line at info@talentism.com and schedule a 30-minute conversation with one of our coaches. We want to hear from you. You can learn more about how we guide our clients at talentism.com, where we share our insights from serving over 800 companies. This episode was produced by John Hunter, with story editing by Jesse Gormazano. Special thanks to Greg Kim, Rachel Kiddo, and Rocio Gonzalez.